there, and welcome to the Church on the Ridge podcast. Before we head into our talk this week, we want to let you know about some ways you can find out more about us. Head on over to our website, churchontheridge.org, or download our mobile app. Also, feel free to check us out on Facebook and Instagram, where you can find out ways to live out your God-given purpose. We are so excited to share this week's talk with you, so let's go check it out.
We start our lives full of potential. Everything is possible. Each of us is an unpainted masterpiece. In those few precious moments, we can still become anything. We can still find our purpose. At some point, we step out. Life begins to happen. We take control. We all have our own story. Yet so many of us share the same scars, the same stumbles. Some pushed. Some take the step willingly. Our palette has become achievement, accumulation, comfort, self-indulgence, self-centered. Our emotions rule us as we seek a fulfillment that we struggle to understand. We become covered in the muck of this world. Most of it, our own doing. What we find is not just emptiness. It's loneliness, stress, anger, disappointment, depression, shame. The masterpiece we set out to create in ourselves doesn't look the way we intended. We have turned away from the one who can perfect us. But all along, there's a tugging on our hearts, on our souls, a calling home of sorts. The way home is not far. It's just a step away. The world whispers that we're already home, or that this home doesn't exist. With one step, though, we are welcomed with open arms. The mess, mistakes, and muck wiped away. The masterpiece that we were meant to be is revealed. What was lost has been found. We are restored. We are God's masterpiece.
Yes, and happy Easter. It's great to see you guys. And that is our hope and our prayer that today, no matter what's been marred in your life, no matter what's been mucked up, that God will restore. Because that's the message of hope and the message of Easter. It was 15 years ago, we opened the doors, and we really got to thank my wife for that because I was reticent. I didn't want to come to Snoqualmie. You ever heard of Snoqualmie? And started church. I had a good job. We had a beautiful house. Our house was on a half an acre. And I'm not saying the houses here in Snoqualmie Ridge, if you live here, are close together. But, you know, my wife and I don't fight. But our neighbors can hear us discussing three houses down. You know, and then I'm at my job, and it was a long ways away. And then I played the kid card. You ever play the kid card? Hey, the kids have their friends and, you know, their school. And why would we take them out of all that and move up here and come to Snoqualmie? And you think when you play the kid card, you've won. It's like, all right, hey, now it's done. We're not going to move. But she was so patient and also so persistent. She knew that God had a masterpiece that he wanted to do in the lives of people. That the people here in this valley, some of them have gone a long ways from what God intended them to be. Let me read you one story. I got an email this week from a man named Bill Castagno. And it says, this weekend is your Super Bowl and World Series for God. Go for it, Pastor Charlie. This is the first Easter I'm excited about after learning what Easter truly means. Church on the Ridge has been the best thing I've ever found. FYI, Easter trivia, he says. William Billy C. Enright Castagno, born April 17, 1960, Easter Sunday at 4:52 a.m. He's an Easter baby. I'm like, oh, that's cool. Then he goes on. He says, my mom's sister every year calls me to tell me the same story. Billy, you were the first grandchild born into both families, and everyone rushed to the hospital to see you. I can't wait for that day. I want a first grandchild. Anyway, everyone races to see an angel. Ah, cool. A sign from heaven born on Easter. When you turned 2 years old, we realized you may be the Antichrist. Christy is my biggest fan, wonderful aunt. She witnessed alcohol and drugs running rampant through both of our families. She and my uncle are devout followers and been praying for me all these years, watching me follow in the family tradition of medicating our pain. And then watching as the chains of my demons were broken. It's been one of her greatest joys. This Easter has more meaning and understanding than I can describe. In his name, thank God for what he has done for me. Best regards, Bill Castagno. You know, some of you may understand the feeling of a parent whose child is living less than what you know they were created to live, less than the masterpiece that God designed for them. You look at their life and you say, that's not the picture we would have painted for them. That's not the picture we dreamed for them. We brought them into this world, and yet the choices they're making are scarring and marring and messing up what I know is God's design. And you would do anything for your child. You sacrifice for your children. If they whine about their school, you're down in the principal's office. If they say they want to play some sport, you buy them the best equipment. You get them coaches. You do whatever you can to get them on the select teams. And in fact, it's been known that parents will even buy their way into the best colleges. We sacrifice, we give for our kids. Now, I wonder, would any of you ever sacrifice your child? Jake Locker was with us just a couple of weeks ago, and he posed that same question to the men in the room, and then he answered it for himself. He says, I wouldn't. I wouldn't sacrifice one of my kids for you, a lot of you. No way. And yet, that's exactly what God did. That's the Easter story. That God in heaven would sacrifice his one and only son so that that which was marred and mucked up could be restored into the masterpiece that he created. Today I want to talk about another son and another dad. A dad who lost his boy. You know, it may seem unrelated to Easter, so hang with me till the end, okay? This guy was known as the GOAT of art, the greatest of all time. His name is Rembrandt von Rijn. You've heard of him. Born in 1606 during the Dutch Golden Age, he painted hundreds of portraits, over 600 paintings. They're still finding paintings from him. Somebody will go through their attic and say, who is this? Oh, it's your great-great-great-grand somebody. And then, oh, look at the signature. That's a Rembrandt. No, they found it. He did a self-portrait. Here he is, if you wondered what he looked like. Very classic of his paintings. He did beautiful scenery. This is known as the Long Bridge. He painted people scenes. This painting is called The Night's Watch, not to be confused with Game of Thrones, but The Night's Watch. He painted and he drew in ink. He used etchings. You know, historians and art enthusiasts alike say that his greatest contribution to the world and to art is his biblical scenes. Here's one where it's Jeremiah lamenting over the loss and the destruction of Jerusalem. This next one is the disciples out on the boat and the storm is raging. In many of his biblical scenes, he would actually do his self-portrait. He would paint himself into the picture, taking on the emotions of what it felt like to be there in that scene, what was going on in the heart of the people who were watching and experiencing what was happening. This next scene, this next picture is one of Jesus. If you grew up with a picture of Jesus in your home, many of them were taken from Rembrandt's depiction. The next scene in which he painted himself as well is the scene of Jesus being taken down from the cross on that fateful Good Friday, the story that began Easter. What must it have been like to be there? Rembrandt was said by Vincent van Gogh, he goes deep into the mysteries into the mysterious, that he says things for which there are no words in any language. It's a justice that they call Rembrandt magician. He said of his own works, I use art to achieve the greatest and most natural emotion. Emotion. Love. Joy. Happiness. Wonderful emotions. And yet, there's the other side of emotion. Hurt. Bitterness. Anguish. Pain. Loss. Emotion. How did Rembrandt become so great at what he did to be known as the greatest of all time? Well, like most great things, they rarely, if ever, come without cost. Rembrandt, a great painter his whole life, was not averse to loss and pain. He watched the first three of his children die within months of their birth. Can you imagine? The child that lived into adulthood, his son Titus, his fourth, was also wrapped in pain, for his wife died shortly after the birth of their son. His whole life living with that loss, that emotion, that grief. How do you medicate? How do you assuage that pain? What do you do? Well, Rembrandt began to amass himself into his art, pour his emotion into his art. But not only pour his emotion into his art, he was very good at what he did. He became very wealthy, and he began to purchase a lot of art, surround himself by greatness. The more he owned, the more he felt like life could then have significance and meaning. He never remarried, but he had many lovers. Hey, if I can buy my way into significance, I can take away the hurt of the past, if I can use people in my life to take away some of the grief, some of the pain, I'll do it. Money will bring me significance and meaning. You know, no wonder money is often referred to as a god. We spend to feel good. We buy things we don't need to take away some of our hurt, give us some sense of value. And Rembrandt took more than he gave. He loved things and he used people. For him, the buying of things and the using of people just became another addiction. His value was wrapped up in what he owned and what he had. He kept looking for others to satisfy his own needs. You know, this painting is nice, but it no longer satisfies. I need another. This person has done some nice things in my life, but she doesn't do it anymore. I need another. You know, unable to stem the inevitable, the laws of economics. He discovered that the bill eventually came due. The bill of satisfying ourselves will one day come due for us as well. And Rembrandt was forced into bankruptcy, left with nothing. His art, had to sell it all. But he could still paint. And as he came to the end of his life, he painted his last picture. Most call it his seminal work, a painting which they say is his life story. It's known as The Return of the Prodigal. Now, don't get excited. It's not the original. It's still in St. Petersburg behind glass. He paints himself into the picture, the prodigal son. Jesus told the story of the prodigal, and many of his sermons that Jesus gave, his talks that he gave, he would use parables or stories that would illustrate a point. The story of the prodigal, many believe, is not a parable, but an actual event. Jesus starts off the talk by saying, suppose those of you, and he's speaking to his crowd, had 100 sheep and one of them wandered off. Would you not leave the 99 and go after the one? And the whole audience is saying, well, yes, of course. And he says, suppose a woman had 10 valuable coins and she lost one of them. Would she not sweep the whole house to find that lost coin? And everyone again is saying, well, yeah, I suppose, yes. And then he changes the verb tense and he says, there was a man who had two sons. No longer a supposition, but there was a man with two sons. And the youngest son came to his father and said, I wish you were dead. Because if you were dead, then I could have my inheritance. And once I had that money, I would be valuable. I would be significant. I would have meaning. I could buy whatever I wanted. I could enjoy life the way I wanted to enjoy life. I could buy the things that brought me happiness. Dad, I wish you were dead. Now, I don't know what you would do if one of your kids came to you and said, you know, I wish you were dead so I could get my inheritance. I know what I'd do. I'd write you out of the will. I'll take care of that right now. Wanting me dead. Well, this dad understood relationships. And he understood the fallacies of youth and some of the things that we long for. And he understood that we can't buy our way into happiness. But in order to not cause a greater rift between him and the boy, he actually showed him mercy and gave in to his wishes and said, okay, I'll give you your inheritance. And the young man thought, hey, my ship has come in. I've won the lottery. And he went out and he began to spend more than he made. He began to take more than he gave. He began to love things and use people, as many of us do. And he felt like his value was going to be in the amass of his possessions and the exploits of his life. And sure enough, the laws of economy came true for him as well. And the bill had come due. And he found himself bankrupt and lost. And there was Rembrandt. And Rembrandt came to his senses. He said, maybe in all these pictures I've painted of biblical scenes, he was never a very religious man, and all these pictures I've painted, maybe this story of Christ could be true, because if it's true, I need it. I've marred my life. I've blemished the masterpiece. I've come up less than what God intended me to be, and now I'm destitute. I don't really have a lot left. Try it in a marriage. Take more than you give. Let me know if the laws of economy will not come due for you as well. That which you started off saying, hey, it's going to be wonderful, is now something less than you hoped. Try it with your children. Expect more of them. Expect perfection. Make sure you push them. Oh, push them so they will achieve. And let me know how it turns out. Try it in a job. Take more than you give. Love things and use people. And see if your employees don't look for greener pasture. You know, the son, with all of his wealth, said, I don't need any guidance. I don't need any authority. I can be my own God. I can amass my own significance. I'll never pay the price. And Rembrandt paints the story. He does a phenomenal job. He uses, in his paintings, never any blues or greens. They're rare to find in his paintings. A lot of dark colors, browns, gaboche, vermilion, jet black, lamp black, charcoal black. His use of light was pretty incredible. The glow on the face of the Father as he shows mercy. The darkness of the face of the son who's in shame. The solemnity of the onlookers. Each one wondering, what will the father do? What would I do if this was my son who came home, who wanted me dead? The tattered clothes of the son, the broken shoes. And if you know me, you know I love shoes. My significance is in my shoes. The nicer your shoes. In your clothing, how well you look. And now they're tattered. That which once brought significance is lost. Notice his hair. How well we look, our physical appearance. I've never had the hair thing going on, but notice the contrast between the hair of the boy and the hair of the father. Well kept, his couture outfit, his attire. But the son is cropped back. Not because he couldn't grow hair, but because it was matted and gnarled and tangled, filled with lice. The best thing to do was simply to crop it close, a sign in that day of shame and loss. If you just glance at the picture, you'll miss some of the nuances. I want you to notice the father's hands. Artists say hands are some of the most difficult physical anatomy to paint, but you notice one hand is on the boy's shoulder, a stern hand, a sign of authority. Another hand is soft, placed on his back, a sign of grace. So here in the Father's heart, you see truth and grace. Both one embracing the Son, but recognizing that for the Son to come home, he must come back under the Father's authority. He no longer can shake his fist at his father and say, I wish you were dead, but Father, I submit myself to you. And you receive the embrace. Rembrandt was done shaking his fist. He too wanted to come back to the Father. You say, nice picture, Charlie. Okay, good story. Why on Easter? Well, if you know the story, the last words that Jesus quotes the Father saying are these. The son of mine was dead. It is now alive again. He was lost, and now he's found. And they began to celebrate. They began to party. You hear those words, his son was lost and is now found, was dead and is alive again. Very familiar to the Easter story. You know, people think the Easter story is so complicated, so difficult, that how hard to understand. I want to reveal to you another painting. Not done by the greatest of all time, but done by a 10-year-old. A young lady who's a part of our church here. She has been raised in the economy that you live in. Never really gone through the pain and the turmoil of life. Oh, she's lost some grandparents. I helped the graveside of her grandmother. But notice she paints the story of Easter when I asked her, and she puts together a lot of blues and greens, colors that Rembrandt would have never used, colors of life and hope. She puts the three crosses on top of the hill, and there in the center is the big-hearted cross of Christ, who God said, I will sacrifice my son so that you can be restored. On both sides of the cross, one is a prodigal who turns to Jesus in the last moments of his life and says, Jesus, can you do anything with this mess? Can you do anything with this jacked-up life? The cross on the other side is another one who's marred his life, but is still shaking his fist and saying, I will not submit to any authority, not to the Romans, not to the Jews, and certainly not to this man who claims to be God. You know, our stuff, our things, give us a sense that we can think more highly of ourselves than we ought to. We have a little success in our job, in our business, have some nice clothes, a nice car, and we think, hey, I don't need any authority in my life. I can be my own God. You know, the greatest soccer players of our day, I mean, we can argue about it for a long time, but we've got to at least put Ronaldo in the argument. And Lionel Messi in the argument, right? Some of the greatest soccer. You know, a reporter went to Ronaldo and said, Ronaldo, why are you so good? How can you be so great at this game? Ronaldo casually looked at him and said, God has willed it that I come to earth and show the world how to truly play this game. The reporter went to Messi and said, have you heard the claims of Ronaldo that God sent him to show the world how to play? Messi's response was simply, I don't ever remember telling him that. It's easy to think more highly of ourselves than we ought. Let me ask you, who is God? Who is God in your life? Is it your things? Is it your money? Is it your abilities? Your looks? The dying thief on the cross would not submit to this God. This God who would send his own son. He said, Jesus, if you really are God, then save yourself. Prove it. Jesus said, I didn't come to save myself. I came to save you and those who would shake their fist at God, those who have marred their life, and those who recognize that they need a Savior, an authority. For the men on the cross, Rembrandt, Bill Castagnos of the world, and some of you in this room, you've come to the place where you recognize the bill eventually comes due. The marriage has not turned out right. The kids have not necessarily lived right. And today, God has brought you here. We can continue to cling to our success, or we can take on the faith of a 10-year-old. Lower our hand. Allow the authority of God to come into our life. The embrace of his grace to cover us. You and I can rise from the mistakes of the past. We can see God restore a marriage that was broken. A child who's lost. Today could be your day. You get to choose, which will it be? A clenched fist or an open heart. I'm going to give you an opportunity in just a moment to actually invite Jesus to come into your mess, to embrace you, to come home to the Father. It's not a profound prayer. It's a very simple prayer. A 10-year-old could say it. But what's profound is what happens in your life, in your heart. For out of the ashes, God can bring a miracle. Did you see the Notre Dame this last week? Did you see the picture the firemen took as they went into the place? There, out of the ashes, was the cross and the altar. You know, they've already raised over a billion dollars to restore Notre Dame. The debt's been paid. It's covered. Do you realize that God already sent his son to be sacrificed for you? Your debt has been paid. It's covered. Now, it may take a little while for them to restore Notre Dame. I would think maybe years. For some of us, it takes a little while for God to restore some of the brokenness and the loss. It's not an instantaneous fix. But the debt's been paid. The price is covered. Now it's just a matter of time and walking with him. We'd love to help you as a church. We'd love you to be a part of it. But only you can pray the prayer of a 10-year-old. Say, Christ, come into my life. I submit to your authority. You are God and I am not. Which will you be today? You know, 15 years ago, Sandy has been praying that you and I would celebrate together. She didn't know who you were then, but she's been praying that you would celebrate that Jesus was dead and is now alive. You know, the wind and the clouds may be covering your world and separating you from family, and you may feel abandoned by those that you once loved. But notice what Sabrina painted behind the storm. There the sun is still shining. Jesus is alive. And the Father in heaven is saying, the son of mine was dead but is alive again. Come on. Let's celebrate. Would you bow your heads? Maybe in the quietness of your own heart, pray this prayer with me. Jesus, I need you. I've mucked up my life. I've made a mess of things. I've taken more than I've given. I've used people and loved things. Now, I need you. I recognize I need an authority. The laws have come due in my life. And I can't pay the price. So today I invite you. I ask you, can I come home? I want to be your son. I want to be your daughter. I want to feel your embrace once again. Take that which is dead in my life and breathe on it, Lord. Raise it from the dead. Raise my marriage. Raise my kids. Change the emotion in my life. I need you. In Jesus' name, amen.